seminar, inauguration seminar of the School of Research Wisdom of University of Jyväskylä. Those of you who have been monitoring the process, you know that we have been working on this project for at least 2 years now. So it's a great pleasure to finally have this inauguration seminar of the School of Research Wisdom. And those of you who have been following this, you also know that the concept and the name of this network has been changing. So finally, this is our end result wisdom network. Today we have a seminar to celebrate and officially open this Resource Wisdom Network, and we have a pleasure to have speakers, our rector. We first welcome Wisdom to the University of Jyväskylä, and I probably could say that finally, welcoming Wisdom to Jyväskylä. And then after that, Janne Kotiau, who has been working on this Resource Wisdom for a year now, he will tell us about what this is this all about, how, what is the concept like, and how do we see ourselves at this point of time. And then we have a Virko Melvi from the City of Jyväskylä. She's Development Director of the City of Jyväskylä, and she's kind of a pioneering person in resource wisdom thinking and resource wisdom actions in Finland. Because the City of Jyväskylä is a pioneering city in resource wisdom already years back. And then finally, last but not least, we have an extra pleasure to have Pekka Haavisto, a member of the Finnish Parliament here, talking about from global sustainability challenges to local actions. So I will give the opening words to Rector of Keijo Hämäläinen, please.
Honorable guests, collaborators, our university community, dear friends. At the University of Jyväskylä, during our strategy process, we have over the last months made an extensive effort in trying to look into the crystal ball and to find our joint vision for the future. It has become clear that the Humboldtian University and the academic freedom are and should be the cornerstones of our university. The research should be unbiased from ideological, economic, political, and religious influences and interests. However, this should not mean that we live in a vacuum in our own academic world, in our academic bubble. University has undoubtedly great impact on the surrounding society, not least in relation to the economic growth, and the need for university-based knowledge and wisdom is larger than maybe ever. We are facing many global challenges which threaten our planet and the whole mankind, and it's our responsibility, by unbiased and independent research, to try to address those challenges. Universities, like all organizations, are under constant renewal processes. I have over the last years given many times a presentation titled "The World is Changing, What About University?" The answer to this question is twofold. Yes, we are reactive. We adapt the needs of the society to give our students relevant employability skills. Yes, we bench learn from other organizations how to run universities more effectively. And yes, we follow the research trends for relevant research topics. On the other hand, we should not only be reactive to our environment, but also be proactive. We should not only follow and predict the change, but much strongly be part of and creating the change. We should vision the better future and work together for the better future. Today, as a rector, I am extremely proud of our researchers and community. You have created an innovative School of Research Wisdom, a platform aiming to make the world a better place to live. Scientists from all our six faculties are enthusiastic to work within different perspectives, reaching from fundamental natural sciences to human behavior, tackling boldly the major issues related to population growth and consumption. Beyond the research activities, everyone is also strongly engaged in actively disseminating their knowledge and combined wisdom to the benefit of society. This part of the activities is actually easier said than done and requires a major effort and also wisdom. At the University of Jyväskylä, we have undoubted scientific excellence to contribute in multidisciplinary way to research wisdom. But what has been the key element here, and what we are hearing today, and what will be the driving force to make this successful is the passion in the heart. We are privileged to have those people at our University of Jyväskylä and also here today. At this point, I would like to express my sincere gratitude for all those who have dedicated their time to realize this new initiative, our university people and our collaborators. Let's make the world a better place to live together. Thank you.
Now I need to make this visible here as well as over there. If somebody is wiser than I am on this matter. Yes, exactly.
No,
because they are different presentations here and there. Okay, so good evening everybody and welcome to this inauguration seminar of School of Resource Wisdom. I am Janne Kotiaho and like Mikko said earlier, I have been putting this together now about a year, but really we started only in January this year to really start putting this together. So I have been doing this together mostly with Panu Halme, who has been helping me during this year to do what we have done. And before me, there have been several other people who have been developing this network forward. Like Mikko said, we have had different names. We have had Bioresource Institute, Sustainability Science Center, but then came Hälsosyn Helsinki. And now finally, we decided that, okay, School of Resource Wisdom, because Jyväskylä, like we hear soon, is the capital of resource wisdom in Finland. So why do we need wisdom? And why in Jyväskylä? Ecosystems are being degraded. We need wisdom to understand how can we stop these kinds of developments. We need wisdom to understand that biodiversity is seriously being eradicated. We need wisdom to understand that the future of humanity is threatened. These three things we need to understand, and therefore, wisdom. I am going to tell you in the beginning a little bit about the state of the world that I was doing assessing together with about 100 colleagues during the last 3 years in Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. This is an independent body that is working under the United Nations, And the purpose of it is to make scientific assessments that are policy relevant and actually give guidance to global policies to go forward in trying to safeguard biodiversity and ecosystem services. So everything that I will tell you about global state of the planet is coming from this assessment. And then there are a couple of bits about Finland as well, and they are from various different scientific publications. So ecosystems are being degraded. Over a third of the land area of Earth is converted to crop and grazing lands. So one third of all of the land area of the planet. About 30% of this area is converted to produce feed and fodder for animals. So not food for people, but for animals. And by 2050, it has been predicted that the demand of animal products will double compared to 2000, which means that this area of land that is used for feed and fodder will increase. Less than one-fourth of land area remains without significant human impact on the planet. By 2050, areas outside significant impact will be less than 10%. And these areas are inhospitable deserts, mountains, tundra, and polar systems. Nothing much else remains in 2050, given business as usual, because these are scenarios. Wetlands and peatlands have suffered the greatest impacts. Overall, 87% of all wetlands and peatlands have been lost globally. And during the last century, 54%. During the 21st century, ecosystem degradation has caused annually 3.6 to 4.4 billion tons of CO2 emissions. So this is about 10 to 20% of the global emissions per year. This is due to agriculture, forestry, forest loss, drainage, and burning of peatlands in this order. So, what about the situation in Finland? We always hear that Finland is much better than all the other places, but is this really the case? So, forests in Finland have been degraded on average by 68%. During the last 15 years, 300,000 hectares of forests that are over 160 years old, which means that they are the truly old-growth forests, they have been lost in the area that is utilizable for forestry. So this is more than 40% of the area that forestry can go. If these rates continue, in 15 years, we have nothing left. Peatlands of Finland have been degraded by 43%, and overall, an average 61% of all biotopes in Finland have been degraded. During 2000 to 2011, about 100,000 hectares of new agricultural field was cleared. And to compare this to the Metso program, which is the conservation program for Finland, it targets the protection of the same about 100,000 hectares of forests. So in the longer term, we want to get the same amount of area covered and protected than what we are actually degrading in much shorter times. This means that globally and in Finland, ecosystem degradation is not slowing down, but it is accelerating. We do have international multilateral agreements that have all the right components and all the right targets. But without immediate massive implementation at the national level, these targets will remain unachieved. Biodiversity is being eradicated. Between 1970 and 2012, Population sizes of vertebrate species have declined by 58%. This means that every second animal, vertebrate animal, has been killed off from the planet. One out of two or more. Freshwater species have declined by 81%. 8 out of 10 individuals of freshwater species have been eradicated. During the last 15 years, we have just heard news that 1/3 of birds have been lost in Europe from individuals. And in Finland, the situation is no better. Birds in agriculture area, we have lost 40% in last 30 years. Birds in peatlands areas, we have lost 30% in last 30 years. Birds in forests, 20% in last 20 years. And if we look further, there is some records from further on, so 50% since 1960. Willow tit, in 10 years we have lost 40% of the population. And in crested tit, in 10 years we have lost half of the population. In 2000, there was a red list done in Finland, and at that time, 35 species of birds were classified as threatened. In 2015, there was a new evaluation done, like it always is, and at that time, already 87 species were classified as threatened. So 2.5-fold increase in risk of extinction in birds in Finland. Threatened species have a high likelihood of going extinct. This means that if nothing is done to improve the conditions of these species, we will lose them in some time frame, not so far from now. What about insects? At the moment, we have globally news about catastrophic declines of insects all over the world. In the United States, in Germany, in Australia, everywhere. And there's a reason for this. About 3 years ago, this intergovernmental platform produced its first reports, and one of them was pollinators, pollination, and food production. And they concluded that 75% of all food crop species that we utilize are needing pollination. And 35% of the global food production volume is dependent on pollination. So our food is critically dependent on there being pollinators. And what happens if pollinators are not there is this. In China, they are already pollinating fruit trees by hand, because there are no pollinators. We cannot do this globally to maintain all of the food sources for us. Back to the assessment. So by 2050, 38 to 46% of the global biodiversity will be lost if something radical is not done. This equals total loss of original biodiversity in an area of 1.5 times the area of USA. And because Europe and USA are the same size, it also means that 1.5 times the area of Europe. So we are no doubt driving the planet towards 6 mass extinction of species. It is unquestionable. And most impacts are due to agriculture, forestry, and development of various infrastructures. Future of humanity is threatened. More than 2 out of 5 people on the planet are already suffering from ecosystem degradation and loss of species. By 2050, land degradation and climate change together will reduce crop yields by an average of 10% globally and up to 50% in some regions, while at the same time the global human population will increase 30%. And unfortunately, the biggest loss of productivity is in the same area where is the greatest increase in human population. So the population in drylands will increase from 2.7 billion in 2010 to 4 billion by 2050. By 2050, land degradation together with climate change are likely to force 50 to 700 million people to migrate. If we think about 2 years ago, what happened? Europe received 1.3 million refugees from south. Finland got about a bit over 30,000. If we calculate the same from the lowest number here, it means that Finland will get about 1 million refugees by 2050. I don't think that there is any need to talk about Finland not giving birth enough to babies. There is not going to be too few people. Land degradation is already costing more than 10% of the annual global gross product in loss of biodiversity and ecosystem services. Underlying drivers of ecosystem degradation and loss of species are our high consumption lifestyles and population growth. And these are issues that are not very often spoken out loud, or details to resolve these are not being discussed enough. The greatest challenge of humanity do not respect traditional faculty borders. This is why we need wisdom. Wisdom is a transdisciplinary network, and it will be growing, it is growing, and it will be growing even bigger. So, like our rector said, we have six faculties now where we have people who are interested in this network. And on top of that, our Open Science Center, the Kokkola University Consortium Chydenius, and the Finnish Institute of Educational Research, that are all part of University of Jyväskylä, they are also interested, and there are research groups that are participating in this wisdom network. So we are truly transdisciplinary already now, even though we started to find these people only from the beginning of this year. Okay, you probably already guess what the mission of wisdom is. Because we are at the university, our main task is to understand and do research to understand even better. So what we want is that we want to excel in research on planetary well-being. And what planetary well-being means, it is the seeking of the truth and trying to get a better and deeper understanding of what this planetary well-being will be, and this will happen through research. And human well-being is intimately dependent on well-being of other living beings, like I was explaining in the beginning, and therefore we use the word planetary well-being. It is more than human well-being, which you hear often nowadays. It is the well-being of humans and the other creatures. Another goal is that we want to advance evidence-based societal decision-making. This we will do by disseminating knowledge and understanding through education, which is our task in university, but also we will actively network in the society as a critical, clear-minded community of scholars. And once we succeed in these aims, then we can reduce the existential risks. That means that we can reduce the threats to humanity's future. Values that we have been thinking that we have is openness, criticality, veracity, and proactivity. Okay, science and understanding first, societal impact second. I used to have here organization as a title, but I changed it because this is better. So this is actually an organizational chart. So basically, Wisdom has some structure. Or it will have some structure. It doesn't have much structure yet. So we have been thinking that we will have management board, the chair of which will be the Dean Mikko Mäntkönen, and one of the members at least is going to be Hanna-Leena Pesonen. Then we have two advisory councils. Societal Impact Council, for which Pekka Haavisto agreed that he can be the chair. Then we also have members here, Mari Pantsar from Sitra and Janne Hukkinen from University of Helsinki. This Societal Impact Council, the purpose of it is to give us information, what is going on our society, what are the tasks that are needed, what are the questions that need answering, and so forth. So it is more about Finland and the local community. What is happening here in Finland? Because then we have the Scientific Advisory Council on the other side, which is going to be international. So here we have the chair, Jörn Fischer from Germany, and two members, Corey Bradshaw from Australia and Atte Moilanen from University of Helsinki. These both councils will be populated with more people, but the purpose of the Scientific Advisory Council is to look at the global trends in all kinds of sustainability issues in their own field and come to Jyväskylä every second year and tell us what's going on that we don't necessarily know, so that we become wiser about the situation in the world and can then act on it. These levels are more, should I say, administrative or advisory, and they are not doing the actual work. Then we will have the group of people who are working in the university in different faculties, in different research groups, and I have listed here in the lowest part in the balls, just in the bubbles, just few, not everybody is here, but you see that there are some research groups already mentioned. They will do their own research in their own research groups without necessarily thinking about wisdom all the time. But then, what is actually bringing the added value is that we are going to convene every second week in transdisciplinary wisdom lunch colloquiums, where we are going to discuss one topic at a time, have lunch, and discuss academically about issues. And maybe we can find something together more than while working on our own. So I believe that this lunch colloquium will be the place where the added value is going to be born for the wisdom. Then we have envisioned some other things. We want to get some internationally recognized names visiting Jyväskylä, and therefore we have been thinking that we should actually establish a Wisdom Fellow program, that we could invite some distinguished researchers to come to visit us and teach us something. We have also been thinking that we will establish a transdisciplinary international wisdom master's program, and this will be in the beginning led by chemistry together with biology and the business school. Then we have wisdom advocacy. So one of the missions was to advocate the truth, or to advocate the use of science in decision making. And when here I chose the word advocacy in purpose, because it is not there to be advocating any certain thing, but it is to advocate the truth. No matter what the decision, in the network of wisdom, there will be people who know about some decisions that are being taken. If the background information is not correct, we can advocate the right information. Also, this is about societal networking or impact, and we have been thinking that we will establish a wisdom blog, which is called, in fact, Itse Asiassa. Then we will have a YouTube channel, which maybe we can compile today from these speaks an opening YouTube video. Words of Wisdom will be launched later in the autumn. And then we have this open wisdom kisakatsomo. They are in Finnish because what we're actually doing is that we live stream panel discussions from Helsinki to Jyväskylä so that we don't have to travel there to listen when we want to listen something about environmental discussion. So we actually had first of these already last week, and it was a great success. We had more people here than what they had in Helsinki. So we managed to do it well. And I must say that for me, it is important that we try to be active towards the society. I have been a researcher in my past that I didn't think about the society at all. And now I am a researcher that actually thinks about the society and tries to understand why the society is thinking the way it is, and I'm trying to influence. And I hope that the wisdom community will also think the same way, that we need to come out of our ivory towers to the society and try to change the world. Here I have an advertisement for an event that we have in Jyväskylä in just 2 weeks. It is the European Congress of Conservation Biology, and of course the topic or the theme of the conference is planetary well-being, a mission that matters. So you are welcome to register still to the meeting. There's going to be about 800 people, so Pavilionki is going to be full. Thank you very much.
Okay, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's my greatest pleasure to be here and tell you something about what we are doing in the city of Jyväskylä. I warmly welcome also Wisdom to do cooperation with us here, and I feel very proud that you chose especially this name for your new network. It's great. Anyway, my presentation is divided into four parts. Basically, I shortly present to you our city, which you probably know already quite well already. And then I tell some words about resource wisdom and circular economy and our aims and our tools, how we try to do the work for to be more resource wise. And then I tell something about cooperation and co-creation, and then ecosystems and platforms. I have quite a lot of slides here, but I think that, but only a few words in each of them. I think that the words tell much more than thousands of words, so that's why I go quite quickly through these slides. City of Jyväskylä is an attractive city which is growing all the time. About 1,500 new citizens every year are moving into our city. And we are one of the fastest growing cities in Finland. We are the second most popular city to move to, and also the third best in the image. And we are the second happiest inhabitants. Do you have any idea where are the happiest people in Finland? Yes, you knew. You was the first person who knew that. I have asked this question many times during my presentations, and nobody has never guessed what would the right answer be. Can you explain what could be the reason?
No. Yeah. I know
more
about it. I just knew that it was Pori.
Yeah, it is Pori. We have to do some benchmarking to Pori, maybe. Anyway, our roots are in education, as you know. And one of three in our citizens are either schoolgoers or students. You can probably notice it when you are going to Kauppakatu down and you only meet young people there. The median age is 24. And one in three has an academic degree. That tells you also a story that we are an academic city. We are also the city of light. We are mentioned to be international pioneer in urban lighting, and we belong also to a network called LUSI, which connects cities like Jyväskylä who are trying to do work for lighting issues globally. We are also a city of opportunities. We have here everything what we need. We have beautiful nature. We live here in the heart of the country, surrounded by lakes and forests. And we have a lot of young people and good hopes for the future. And now we only have to do things together and act so in that way that the sustainable future is here. The city of Jyväskylä is committed to resource wisdom in the longer run. We have a development plan until 2050. And also in this, the newest strategy of the city, you can see that those four spearheads of it, that one of them is wise use of resources. It means that this resource wisdom is integrated into our management, all the budget processes and so on. Resource wisdom and circular economy, I don't need any more explanation what do they mean after Janne's presentation. We face globally big challenges which are not at all easy to solve. Sustainability is something we all should take attention to. As you can see, one day, son, all this will be yours. I think it explains quite a lot. Resource wisdom started in the year 2013 in the city of Jyväskylä when we started a joint project with Finnish Innovation Fund, Sitra. Sitra chose our city to be a partner when creating a regional operating model for cities to create sustainable well-being from a circular economy and carbon neutral economy. Since that, even though the project itself has finished already 3 years ago, we go on this work very systematically and we passionately want to do our best for our whole region. It's not a regional model for the city organization, it's a model for our region. We have very, very big aims. We want to be zero emission. We are aiming zero emissions, zero waste, and no overconsumption. Big, even idealistic aims, but we strongly believe that we can reach them if we do work together. And I already mentioned that we have a long-term plan for this work, and we have a roadmap which has six different themes in it for to make it more easier to understand what it's all about. These streams are renewable energy, sustainable transport, waste as a resource, local food, valuable water, and sustainable communities. And for all of these themes, we have certain step marks what we are going to do until we have reached our aims. Now, this model which we created here is now also 10 other cities have taken this model to follow. These cities in Finland are all over the country. There are Turku, Lahti, Vaasa, Kuopio, Lappeenranta, Forssa, Hyvinkää, Riihimäki. Did I mention everyone? Joensuu is the last one. So quite many Finnish cities already have these roadmaps and are committed into these aims. I'm very optimistic that in our future will be much nicer than what Janne just explained. Experimental culture is one of our maybe the best and most important tool which we use when doing this work. We want to prototype sustainable actions. We want to do something small and quickly, inexpensive experiments to test out new ways of behaving and doing things. And when we started this project with Finnish Innovation Fund, Sitra, we collected or opened the open call for citizens to get ideas or to give ideas to us how to live in more resource-wise way. And during 1 month open call, we got more than 2,200 ideas, which were from the tiny ideas to a huge ones, which we have no tools to do anything about. But anyway, we divided those ideas into those five themes and chose few from all of them and to be experimented as a trials. And so maybe one of the most or the best trials was that leftover lunch trial, which then spread over whole country. Who has ever or never heard about leftover lunch trial? A few of you haven't. It was an idea that in one school kitchen that there's always some food left in the kitchen and in the lunches. And there was an idea that all the leftover food will be given to the poor people or unemployed people in that region. And even though in one lunch there was only maybe 5 to 10 portions of lunch, leftover lunch, if you think how much would it be if you scale it to every school, to every day and to whole country, then the impact would be very, very big. And now this leftover lunch trial has expanded into over 30 cities in Finland, and it's really, really great trial or experiment. We really think that less resources means also more well-being, or it can mean that. We do a lot of experiments and also campaigns for to brand things and for to, in this case, we want to encourage people to use more public transportation. One of those funny campaigns we did, that we had a campaign for
free transportation if you have your Christmas hat on. This was very, very nice day, and all the people came to the buses and with their Christmas hats, and normally very serious Finns were chatting with each other, and some of them even started to sing Christmas carols in that bus. So it was nice idea, which has a very serious meaning in it, but on the other hand, we used humor in this sense, and it was nice and relaxing way to travel. And of course, already that has some impacts on, like you can see, it doubled the amount of passengers during that day, which also means the reduction of CO2 emissions. Now we have been doing work with one EU project called CircWaste, which is based on waste management. And in that big project, we have one osahanke, what would it be? Anyway, we have one osahanke, which is based on experimental, and we try to find ideas from citizens how to create circular economy, user-orientated circular economy trials. And the first open call is now over, and the first trials have been done, but the next open call will be next autumn. We want to learn by experimenting. Experiments are the tool for agile development. We strongly believe that it is very good for also the municipalities to start doing by experimenting. Of course, we're still doing the projects, but also the experiments. These short and quick and easy and inexpensive experiments are part of our change management. It really challenges the business as usual, and we have a possibility to learn by doing. And at the same time, also the sustainability gets acceptance. We need also interpreters in this work. We need a lot of research, a lot of high quality truth, as Janne said, but we also need right words to tell the citizens about them and to raise up the importance of it. That's why we counted also these trials we created a few years ago, the impacts of what it would mean if they would be enlarged in the regionally. And it's no doubt that the impacts were huge. I think circular economy and resource wisdom, they can really create added value for the region, as well as a lot of jobs, like you see in this case, about 1,000 new jobs. And no need to mention also this reduction of CO2 emissions, huge amount of them. Mustankorkea biogas plant was opened last autumn here. We are very proud that finally this chicken-egg problem is solved in this area. We finally got that biogas plant, and now our duty is try to increase amount of biogas use in traffic. And in this task, we are doing a lot of cooperation with all the other stakeholder groups in this area. All the public bodies are working for biogas usage in traffic, and we have quite many companies also doing work for it, as well as NGOs. Here you can see some examples of how we try to reach citizens and give them info, different kind of information, how to what does it mean to have a biofuel car, for example. And we are very proud that we have also already few waste management cars here. What are they, the right, real name? Anyway, we have them in our city. We have created an ecosystem of biogas here in Middle Finland, and I think this is quite unique in the whole country. These three words I next want to point out is that we have traditionally spoken about customer orientation, but little by little we have changed to do things together, and we are speaking about cooperation. But the newer word, we have come even further. Now we create together, co-creation. Now we need everyone, we need different people, different knowing how, and so on, to create together. And we always are certainly more than 1 + 1 is more than 2 or 3. It's even 5 or 6. An excellent example of this co-creation is what you have done here in the university with our energy company, Jyväskylän Energia. The experts of chemistry and those working in the energy company, they did years some work for to find out the process and technology to recover precious and rare materials from electronic waste. This technology is an excellent example of circular economy, which has also a huge business potential. I already said that together we are more. We need different colors, different knowing hows, different age people, different expertise, and so on. In the city organization, we try to encourage employees to give their ideas. Those who are working in their daily life with those very practical issues, they are the best experts of knowing how to make those processes better. And we have ongoing open search for the ideas to develop our city services. We also invite everyone to innovate with us. Citizens' engagement and direct democracy belong to our daily life. We want to do together in circular economy, in resource wisdom, but also in everywhere what the city is doing. One, maybe the most important or the most interesting example of this co-creation is how we started this Kangas project, the development area of city of Jyväskylä. It used to be a paper mill which was then shut down, and city bought the land, about 25 hectares. And we started the before there was nothing done. We started the citizens' engagement process, where we invited people to come and give ideas what kind of an area they would like to Kangas be in the future. And we collected a lot of good ideas, and from we gave them to architects, who they started to do the plan. But the basic of all the plans were from those ideas we got from the citizens. And now soon Kangas will be an excellent area to live and work, with its 5,000 inhabitants and 2,000 jobs. And it also gives us a good platform for to do those experiments and prototyping. Here you can see one picture where all those wishes are collected together. Most of the people wanted to save those old paper mill building and also try to take advantage of this river which is running through this area. and they wanted to see Kangas as a very sustainable area and also smart area where all kind of digitalization possibilities is used. And it's not a car-free area, but it will be an area where cycling and walking are the best ways to move from A to B. And in Kangas, smart solutions are to be implemented, like solar energy and metering of consumption and waste management and so on. And here you can see some collection of those wise and smart solutions which will be there in Kangas. If you are interested in hearing more about this, please don't hesitate contacting me or then Tanja Oksa or what was the name of the other? Anyway, you can contact and I'll be happy to give you some further information. When you are talking about sustainability or smart city, the digitalization is the key. Digitalization is an enabler of all kind of new ways of doing things. But it's not the only thing you need. You need a lot of cooperation and platforms. And in the city of Jyväskylä, we have now this Kangas development project, but we also have three other very important projects going on. The city center, Hippos, and Hospital Hill, or Kukkula as it in Finnish. Hippos will be a number one center of sport, physical recreation and well-being, and also solutions for resource wisdom or circular economy are implemented in Hippos area. And by the way, just now the city council is deciding whether to give money for Hippos or not. Very important moment right now. Or the city council meeting has just started at 6 o'clock. So quite interesting moment. We also are proud to have here a new hospital. Oh, it's not quite ready yet, but it's almost ready. And there also we try to implement different kind of circular economy solutions or resource wisdom. The new Nova Hospital will be the first in resource wisdom in the whole country. We certainly have to do with less, but with more together. And so I end my presentation with saying that together towards resource wisdom with wisdom. So welcome to Jyväskylä Wisdom. Thank you.
Thank you. It was very interesting to hear practical examples of what city has been doing and will be doing in the future. And I noticed that this is the network of university of Jyväskylä nicely fit with the idea that you have had, because also this university network, wisdom network, is based on kind of idea of openness and idea of co-creation and co-design. And wisdom is an open network for all people who are interested in research and education in resource wisdom. Any comments or questions to Pirkko? Immediately, we can have a discussion afterwards. If you have any immediate,
a very small technical question: how do you plan to obtain a zero CO2 emission?
We have a lot of steps marks there, and little by little we are.
What's the time frame for the ultimate goal?
Framework. I think we have the, of course, this energy theme is the most difficult, and we are a little bit suspicious if we manage that.
So we energy production?
Any energy production, yeah.
Yeah.
Because of this getting back in.
Yeah, it's very, very challenging.
Yeah. Jyväskylä Energy Company, because they do their best for to try to increase the amount of renewable energy. But of course, it's also business wisdom to use this plant as well as it works, and try to do other things.
Okay, thank you. Now we move on, and our last speaker, because partly mine is not yet served here, would be Pekka Haavisto. I don't think that Pekka needs an introduction anymore, so I will give the floor to Pekka, and he will tell us about from global sustainability challenges to global action.
Thank you, Dean, Rector, Professor. It's a pleasure. I have water. It's a pleasure to be in Jyväskylä, and when I was coming by train, I was thinking that, well, wisdom is certainly not a new thing for Jyväskylä. Of course, there's a long history, but in my personal life, Jyväskylä has meant quite a lot. In the end of the 70s, early 80s, you know, I coming from the generation that maybe didn't anymore believe to Marx, Engels, and Lenin, but we believed to Juntunen, Mehtonen, and Vilenius, who were the philosophers in Jyväskylä. Some of them somehow were in exile from Helsinki. Their thinking way was not accepted by the Helsinki University, so in Jyväskylä came some kind of hub of these thinkers, and we always came to different events and seminars and to Jyväskylän kesä happenings to listen to these gentlemen, and of course then we went to Jyrki Pölkki's kitchen. This was called Älylä, and he was living in Vähä-Älylä, in a place where he was only planning the Estelle ship, then to make the direct contribution to the third world, and finally end up to the Gaza coast and still remaining there, I guess so, by Israeli authorities and so forth. So Jyväskylä was always the place where a lot of ideas, a lot of new issues were here, of course, philosophers then later, like Kari Palonen, or researchers like Kari Palonen and Toivo Salonen and Juha Olavinen, all of them have been very important part of my life in this kind of philosophical and thinking way. And I don't know what happened then. After that, maybe the Pori Arena came or something like that, partly replacing that philosophical school actions and thinking, but it was a very, very important part of that generation's life, and probably now with this new initiative it will mean also important things for new generations. I'm thinking to speak something about the global sustainability challenges, and I didn't choose by chance this Noah's Ark picture there. It was difficult to find a good picture. I don't know, by the way, about the copyrights. We should be very careful here in Jyväskylä about those. But I chose this because when I was 14 years old in Stockholm, there was the first global environmental conference. I wanted to go there, but my parents were thinking that I'm too small to travel alone. But my friend who was 15, Kai Vaara, he went there, and he was bringing from this Stockholm conference to our small club, environmental club in the school, first ever recycled paper print, which I have seen, this kind of small booklet, and it was going in hand to hand, and we were looking at that very bad printing quality, by the way, and we were thinking that this is the future, you know, this is how we save the forests of Finland and so forth. And I still remember how it influenced us in the school club and our ecological thinking. Well, we all see the news, man-made catastrophes like climate change, natural catastrophes, earthquakes, diseases like Ebola, political turbulence, radicalization issues. We are actually living in a world where we cannot speak so much about the sustainability. We almost have to think how we, on a daily basis, can cope with different challenges. And when we look the news More deeper, we find issues like population growth, poverty, urban growth, migration, land degradation, overconsumption, increase of traffic, water scarcity, greenhouse gases, traditional pollution issues, loss of forests, loss of biodiversity, chemicals in agriculture, overfishing, plastic in oceans, inequality, all this very unstructured way in the news and in the media. And then, of course, we have been creating something like idea of sustainability, of sustainable development, and we think that there are three pillars in this. There is the natural environment, there is the economic vitality, there are the healthy communities, or if you go a little bit deeper in these three specific areas in environment, you could list issues like minimizing use of hazardous substances or using energy resources efficiently, using environmentally sound materials and energy, protecting biodiversity, minimizing waste and emissions. Or when you come to the society sector, you can complying with the law, respecting human rights, good community relations, good working conditions, treating suppliers fairly, ensuring product safety. Or when you come to the economy, combating bribery and corruption, investing in infrastructures, creating jobs, contributing to local economy, generating sales and profits, which is actually quite interesting. When you have a company, you should maybe live on the plus side, because then you can pay taxes in a responsible way and pay salaries and so forth. And you should also drive innovations. All these kind of ideas could be put in this sustainability framework. And of course, if you go deeper on this, you can have different dimensions of sustainability and in environmental sustainability, maintaining the integrity of life support systems, biodiversity and ecosystem services, which we learned already about. Environmental sustainability is fundamental to a sustainable future, as we understand. Or when we look to social sustainability, equity within and between generations and within and between ethnic and societal groups. And I think this equity between generations is quite an interesting topic, that we should, yes, we have a right to live on this planet, but in a way that we are not consuming the next generation's possibilities. People's mental and physical well-being, cohesion of communities based on fair distribution of natural resources, health, education, human rights, culture and values are there. And then the third, the economic sustainability, using resources to provide necessary and desirable products and services for the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to do the same, which is quite an important principle. And I would actually even put now a fourth leg to this debate, and it's about the cultural sustainability. Nourishment and sharing of attitudes and values that represent diverse way of viewing the world, ethnic minorities, languages, indigenous people, religions, seeking sustainable solutions without compromising cultural diversity. I think actually this culture, different indigenous groups, religions, languages, is something that we, to understand the world and try to work in a positive way in a global sense, we should learn more and more about this. I have seen many people who have also learned languages, but not maybe understood the cultures where they are working with that language. And it's better that you understand the culture and you are foreign to the language. But if you understand the language, but you don't understand the culture, that's a real problem. I think this reading the different cultures, understanding the different cultures is something that we should maybe emphasize more in our thinking. If you look a little bit back to the environmental debate, of course we had in 1972 actually the first, this limits to growth thinking by the Club of Rome and all these doomsday scenarios. And I remember very well when actually 1973, I think it was the oil crisis. Actually, it was caused by the political reasons, but our government carefully printed this kind of yellow, nice leaflet to every post box where it gave advices that don't wash your car with the warm water, and the city lights have to be closed in the night. I was thinking the light, city of the lights, Jyväskylä, what's happened in the energy crisis and so forth. And it's actually, when you read that booklet, it was almost like a doomsday scenario those days, but nowadays quite actually modern thinking that how to save energy, how to behave in a way, how to consume in a way that you minimize your energy use. And that was distributed to each and everyone in Finland, because we were thinking that we are in a crisis. Actually, there were even discussions that should we close the TV channels on Mondays. So we should have dark Mondays, no TV, which is and nowadays a quite interesting idea as well. And then when you look to environmental milestones, of course you can go even deeper, and I don't, you could go more than 100 years actually. You probably noticed that in the last week in the Economic Forum in St. Petersburg, now the environmental issues were raised up quite strongly, and particularly the sustainable use of forest or protection of the forest. And the Russian minister referred that actually the whole basis of the Finnish thinking of saving forests comes from Russia during the Tsar time, when the Russians were concerned how the Finns were using their forests. So it's and part of that is, by the way, truth. How Punkaharju and other first nature protection areas were created and so far. And, or you can go to the very long history of the nature protection in the United States. It's not the country where we think that has a deep roots in the forest protection but or nature protection, but when you go to Yellowstone and others parks, they were created before in Europe the thinking of the nature protection was popular. But if I come a little bit earlier, you can refer to marine biologist Raquel Carson's Silent Spring 62 about the chemical pollution. Paul Early, the population bomb, 1968, where the population dimension was raised up. First Earth Day in US, 1970. It has quite a history, actually. Club of Rome, Limits to Growth, 1972. Stockholm Conference, which I mentioned, 72. And that led, actually, to the establishment of United Nations Environment Program, UNEP, which is still active and kicking in, based in Nairobi. Then the oil crisis, which raised these concerns, Chernobyl nuclear accident 1986, which somehow came this night, put alive these nightmare scenarios, what can be linked to the nuclear use of the nuclear materials. Then Brundtland Report 1987, Our Common Future, where the idea was combined actually when Stockholm Conference was criticized by the developing countries that it's easy to speak about the pollution when you have all the luxury around you and you have all the wealth around you and so, but you cannot offer anything to the developing world on these issues. And then actually Brundtland Report combined the issues of poverty, the issues of the development to the issues of environment and sustainable development. That was a very important milestone. I always put always on my list the California Zero Emission Vehicle Rule 1990, when actually they made legislation to the future, that California should have this and this year so and so many zero emission cars, and those cars were not invented yet. But they just made a legislation, you know, to push the industries to create those cars. And at the moment, if I understand the story correctly, Toyota in Japan was in deep difficulties with the hybrid technology because they didn't have market. And suddenly came California and saved them, and you had actually Japanese cars conquering or occupying the market in California based on this legislation. It's probably saved the Japanese car industry in a nice way. Then came the Rio Conference 1992, where actually even Gorbachev was present and so forth, where this collapse of the Soviet system, Eastern European changes were one big issue, and that of course was linked very much to the openness. Suddenly people who wanted to say how bad is the situation with the environment could speak out in their own countries when the authoritarian rule was finished. It had a big meaning. And of course first time in Rio 92 the climate issues were taken seriously. I have also put on my list Kensaro Viva hanging, not only because Ultra Bra is singing about this very tragic event, but also because the human rights and environment are so interlinked in so many cases. I always remember when I met the Pakistani Greens, and I asked from them, I didn't actually know that there are so many green people in Pakistan, even in Waziristan, which is a Taliban area and so forth. And then I asked from them that, what is the biggest environmental problem in Pakistan? And the answer was immediate: human rights, freedom of speech. Because if you raise your voice against some project by the government or by the local government, you are in danger immediately. You don't have the freedom, actually. You are attacked by the authorities immediately. Kyoto Protocol, 97. I was happy to be present in this very historic moment as leader of Finnish delegation, as Finnish environmental minister that time. A Japanese environmental minister who was leading, chairing the meeting. The last minutes were, by the way, very tragic because Minister Oki, Japanese minister, asked then, when the final conclusion was there, very difficult to agree and negotiate, he asked that any objections. And then quite many Arab countries were started to wave their hands. And then Minister Oki said, I don't see any objections. Pam, decided. I was like, wow, is this UN democracy? Well, but it was maybe a good thing. But then he burst to tears. And I was thinking that the Minister Oki was crying because he was so happy that he finally got the conclusion. But no, he was crying because he thinks that -6% that Japan committed herself is ruining the economy of Japan. He was thinking that actually now we made a decision that will make a total catastrophe for Japanese economy. I was like, well, you know, European Union also took quite a big figure that time and so forth. And later we know that it wasn't a catastrophe. But the mood was that, you know, we make a big step, but a very, very risky step. And if now when we look back, 97 Kyoto is nothing compared with what has then been decided in Paris, and even more, as we know, needs to be done. Energiewende legislation in Germany, 2010, it's of course a turning point that the country in the middle of Europe, actually without the European colleagues, is just deciding to go on in a renewable energy direction and even close to nuclear and out from coal and so forth, and it is Germany. And I was a couple of times part of the peer review of German sustainable development, and really our conclusion was that, well, this is a very brave move what you are heading to. If somebody can afford it, it is Germany who can probably do it. But there was one interesting phenomenon, since we are talking to scientists here. The German politicians were very angry to scientists in many of these sustainable development meetings, because they were thinking that they have put so much money to science and so little resources are coming and so little inventions to prevent the climate change or bind the CO2 emissions to some new recycling processes. That was a big German dream, that we can use coal, but somehow the CO2 will be used as a new raw material and not in the atmosphere and so on. And we have invested to science so much, and so little results are coming out of all these investments. And we need more efficiency from the science, and the scientists have to do their work. And the scientists were sweating in these meetings. And I was thinking, well, if you do that in Finland, that you start to say to scientists, hey, guys, you have to do this and this and this and this, there will be a lot of objections. You know, scientists will say, sorry, there's a freedom of science. Politicians should not intervene and so forth. But the dynamics of this German debate was, for me, surprising, I have to say. It was interesting. And then, of course, we have Paris Climate Agreement and so forth. There are many ways of making the picture of where our planetary boundaries lies. And in this picture, of course, you can see which issues are coming on the red zone, on the red climate change is there. Biochemistry, nitrogen cycle is there, biodiversity loss is there, and then some other pillars who are coming close to the red ones. I like actually this just as a diagram showing how we are proceeding and where are the biggest risks probably. And population growth, of course, has already been mentioned, but I think it should not be underestimated that while we are coping with the emission problem and while we are coping with the limited resources, we are more on this planet who are sharing these resources. And everybody and each of us should have actually sustainable possibilities for education and for jobs and others. And this population pyramid is going to make one of the big challenges for us. And of course, when you look at the population projections, there is one continent that is growing now very rapidly. Earlier, of course, it was Asia. Asia is coming down, of course, due to the Chinese one-child policy, for example. But Africa continent from 2015 to 2100 is going from 1 billion to 4 billion in these scenarios. And this part is something that is very, very difficult to challenge. And if you compare even the Africa and Europe population, actually, I think it was 1995 when we were equal. We had an equal population on these two continents. And then you see the scenarios, again, up to 2100 from Africa and from Europe. And that's the closest continent to us. And I think we really should understand that quite a lot is needed for the development, and particularly I would say that actually the role of women is a key in this. If you look what are those soft means that you can influence these issues, certainly is girls' education, women education, equality between men and women, more women in business communities and more rights for women. At least it has been working in other societies also to the right direction. But it's interesting how super sensitive actually the population issue in the nowadays world is. I'm not only referring to difficulties in Europe with the Catholic Church and others, but even globally, how difficult it's to address. And it's interesting that since 1945, when UN was established, there has been three world conferences. One in Bucharest in 74, then in Mexico City 84, then in Cairo 94, and then basically nothing. We have ended our talk on population globally because we cannot run it. And I was some weeks ago in Geneva, and I asked some from the UN colleagues, could we propose a world population agreement, world population convention, something even as a voluntary one, that if you make a national plan for population, you get some benefits probably from the World Bank, from the UN system and others. You can easier handle than your national program or national plan. And people say, no, don't touch this topic at all. If we go now to the common table, we will lose the 1994 principles of Cairo. We will go backwards. So we have a Cairo document in the nowadays world is quite radical. And we are afraid of losing it, so better not to have conferences on population. I was like, don't be serious. But that's the mood at the moment, that we have a problem, we have, so to say, an elephant in the room that we cannot handle or we cannot talk about. And this we should be quite concerned about. And of course, part of this population issue is the rapid urbanization. We have seen it in our countries. We all know what this means in developed world, but also in the developing countries. Actually, when you have big families in Kenya, for example, in the village level and so forth, of course, what those youngsters are doing who are seeking for a better life, they are heading to the big cities, to Nairobi and others, and there comes the slums, and there comes the social problems and sanitation problems and environmental problems and so forth. But it's very interesting how rapidly this is now going. I was in Central African Republic. It's a Finnish side country, landlocked country, a little bit around 5 million inhabitants, of course, very much been in a conflict recent years. We went to the capital, but then we went to a small village called Bogangola. And a couple of thousand people, I guess, live in Bogangola. And there was a kid at the street, Sandy Street, with a cellular phone. But there was not electricity in the village, or there was not a tele network in the village. So I asked from the kid that, what do you do with your mobile phone? He said that he's taking photos. I said, how do you charge your mobile phones? He has a small solar panel. He's charging the phone and taking photos. And then he said, I'm waiting for the network to come. And Central African Republic is a country where electricity network is covering 10% of the country. So before it comes to Bougainvillea, it can really take 10 or 20 years, to be very honest. But people are already in the mood, in the urbanization, so probably when this guy is 15 or 17 or something, like, he's no more there, but he's already in the capital and so on, adopting actually the lifestyle and knowing very well how people live in those parts where they have electricity and possibilities. Of course, the sanitation issue, unfortunately, it's some of these developing countries where that's the worst, and of course it's very much linked to the health and health challenges. Again, if we think positively, what Finland can offer, what kind of technologies we have, yes, sanitation, clean water, these are the issues. But it's always good also to remember, and I liked very much the debate that we had in a foreign affairs committee with some of actually our environmental consultants. There was from the Gaia consultant company, some experts, who said that we shouldn't be in an international cooperation only for export. We should be there to learn more, because otherwise we will drop out from the business. We need to know about the problems of the world. We need to know about the technologies of the world. If we are not there, we are out of the business. And it was somehow, it turned almost that we are the one who are benefiting when we are there and we learn more. And I think it's good to keep in mind. Unequal prospect for people in different regions in the Human Development Index, of course. Again, Africa is not performing well. And of course, at the same time, when you have the population scenario and you have the Human Development Index program, that's you have a very, very challenging situation. Where is the development or where the human progress is slowest and fastest? It's not a surprise that countries like Norway and Australia and Switzerland, this is 2013, Netherlands, United States is there. Then we have actually very often the conflict-related countries like here, Sierra Leone, Chad, Central African Republic, Congo, Niger, on the lowest part. And this, again, stresses the link between the conflicts and poverty and lack of development. And unfortunately, conflict prevention and handling the conflict is maybe the most rapid way of getting to some kind of development in these areas. Then we can speak about our footprints, global ecological footprints, how many earths we need for our lifestyle. If you are in America, you need basically 5 planets to keep your lifestyle on. If you are living in Western Europe, you need 3 Earths with that kind of lifestyle. Then down to Central and Eastern Europe, Latin America a little bit less, Middle East. And then when you are in Asia and Africa, you are actually, your living standard is actually meeting the resources of the world. An interesting idea. I'm also hearing more and more speaking about this not only footprint but handprint. And handprint, of course, is something what kind of effort you make for the change. What is your activity, level of activity? So we are not only passive consumers who are making some kind of footprints around, but we are also active people in the political scene, social scene, economic scene, and with our work we can change our, so to say, through our handprint, we are changing also our footprints. I think it's a nice way of thinking that the activity also matters. Hunger map, again, the same type of picture around the world, Asia, Latin America, but some of the red zones in Africa. Global health differences, again, map is not very different from this perspective. This is the map of how people, what is leading causes of lost years of life. And you see the gray areas, they are the heart diseases, and it's are actually most countries have where the loss of life or loss of years is relevant. But then comes the orange, the HIV AIDS sectors there, and even blue malaria sectors and so forth. world energy. We have been talking already about the energy consumption and the perspectives of renewable and sustainable energy. Of course, it's still unfortunately the fact that the amount of oil, used amount of the oil, is increasing, even coal globally and so forth, and the other renewables are still a small part there, and the overall, of course, consumption has been growing quite rapidly. But maybe the good scenario is what is happening in the European Union. This is turning down the overall consumption of energy, and at the same time the renewable is a little bit or growing a little bit faster than earlier in this. And of course, then you can go this energy consumption per person per year. There is EU, US, and Japan are here together on the red one. Here is the former Soviet Union countries, and here is the remainder part of the world. So you can the differences are quite visible, as are the differences in using the global raw material use. 10% of population consumes up to 50% of the raw materials. The blue ones are France, Germany, Japan, United Kingdom, United States, five countries together using, in some cases, more than 50% of issues like nickel, aluminium, copper, tin, zinc, and so forth. One issue that always here as a Finn surprises me is when we speak about the irrigation and need of water, because when you look at the freshwater use, how it's increasing, the amount that is increasing in agriculture, it's a huge. And then it's lower on the domestic, industrial, and reservoirs. But the agriculture use is huge. So actually, in world agriculture, it's very much depending on irrigation and use of additional water. And of course, sometimes these issues are a little bit mixed. You probably have been following the question of the dam, Renaissance Dam, between on the River Nile, between Ethiopia and Egypt. And Ethiopians are building the dam, and Egyptians are very, very concerned that this will actually take down the amount of the water in the River Nile and threaten the sustainable livelihoods on the downriver on the Nile. Ethiopians are saying, we just build a reservoir, we are not taking away a liter from the water. We just do the reservoir, and then when the reservoir is ready and filled, then we give you all the water again. But actually, what Egyptians are suspicious about, and I think we could be suspicious about, is that once you build a reservoir, who can control to what kind of purposes the water is taken from the reservoir? There is maybe agricultural needs. Somebody wants to, you know, make a small lead here and another lead here and another lead here. There are maybe some domestic needs and so forth. It's very, very difficult to control after building of the dam. And this is one of the most serious conflicts currently in that part of the world between Egypt and Ethiopia on the water issue. And usually the rule is that downstream people are extremely concerned about the quantity and quality of the water. Upstream people couldn't care less, you know, because they always have the water there. And this same dynamics when you go to Mekong, when you go to Nile River and so forth, it's always there. And I think the water conflicts will, in the future, grow even further. And here is the food supply map on the how many areas are relying on irrigation. And particularly here, which was for me a surprise, for example, Afghanistan, how actually their whole cultivation system is based on the irrigation and irrigation channels. And of course, it's one of those areas where the poppy opium cultivation is very popular. Why opium? If you look from, if you would be a MTECO activist and thinking what is the most profitable way of doing the agriculture, you would probably choose as well that, because it's actually needs very little water, and it's the price is very high, and it's very difficult to compensate with some other plant which has the same character, needs very little water, has very high price on the market, but of course should be compensated. arable land per capita declines, of course, partly also for the population growth, but we need, of course, the food demand is growing, the animal feed demand is growing, and now the biofuel demand is, so to say, a new factor, of course, on the arable land. And I somehow, there could be many different diagrams on this, but I like this FAO diagram where actually shows how limited use of soil we have on this planet, because the green one, 11%, is the one that don't have any limitations. Then comes to 28% soil to dry, so the deserts and desertification, which is increasing and so forth. Then an area with the chemical problems, 23% of the soil. Then soil to shallow, 22%. Soil to wet, 10%. And then comes the permafrost, 6%. So that actually one-tenth basically is without any limitations, again giving some challenges to the agriculture. Global temperature, we all know these scenarios, different IPCC scenarios, how it's growing and how we actually, with some scenarios, really feel that we are already too late, that it's very difficult to turn. And we have the rising trend of sea level globally going up. And then, of course, close to us, the Arctic regions, which are changing the permanent ice cover and so forth, with all those problems that we so well know. But something that is not so familiar to us is the sea level rise consequences, and not only on some islands. I just read that from the Tonga Island, they plan a total evacuation on the Pacific Ocean if the sea level rises. Everybody has to leave and so forth. But in Bangladesh, for example, they have been calculating this, that if 1.5-meter sea level rise will happen, 17 million people, which is 15% of the population, will have to be evacuated from these areas. And then you are speaking of such an amount of people that it will be very, very difficult for countries like Bangladesh, for example, to handle. I was in India in this famous Terry conference by Mr. Pachauri, the IPCC gentleman, and there was a minister from Bangladesh and there was a minister for India, and it was very close that they started to fight on the issue when the Bangladesh minister said that if this happens, India has to open its border. And the India minister said, no, we will never open our border for environmental refugees, just keep your problem there. So it was a very, the tone of the discussion, what can be the consequences of environmental refugees, wasn't a very pleasant tone. And I think already the professor here referred what could happen even in Europe on this issue. The pollution, the carbon dioxide emissions, of course, we have different kind of world map, but this is maybe a little bit funny one because it shows the continent of Africa is here, and of course Europe is here, and America and China and so forth. You can draw the world maps according to the emissions, and of course, or you can make this type of diagrams. Diagrams where, of course, you see then the United States and some Arab countries there up, and then some very, very low-level countries there, or per capita emissions with this kind of balloons. Actually, in Kyoto, which I mentioned, it was a very interesting philosophical debate on Kyoto, on who is responsible for the emissions and how we should start this reduction of the CO2 emissions. There were proposals by the Indian minister and G77 ministers that, hey, we admit that this is a global problem. Can't we share it equally so that each human being on this earth has a personal quota on CO2? And if we happen to have a little bit extra quota in India, we can sell it to you very cheaply and we can make some business. And then the Western countries say, no, this has to be based on the historical development of emissions, and since we have 10 times higher emissions or something like that, that's the zero level, so to say, and then we count, you know, because you don't have emissions, you are in another situation. And then came this debate, do we have right to emissions, to first have as high emissions as you have, and then we should reduce, and so forth. Or then came to American viewpoint, which was, it's not the state who is polluting. It's their private business. So let us private business to agree how they reduce this. This is not responsible of states. And then we had to say, well, but you know, the private businesses are not making international legislation. It's the states that are making international agreements. So if we leave it to private business, there's nobody to make these agreements, and so forth. We have, of course, all this discussion that what's happening when all the Chinese will have a fridge. We can also think that when their car density is as high as we have vehicle numbers and so forth, we have very rapidly growing areas in the world and both consuming materials and also polluting. But we have other biodiversity problems with the fish stocks, for example. When I was working in Somalia, the usual story or narrative of Somalis themselves about the piracy was directly linked to the fish. They said that when there on the Somalian and coastal area in Puntland and so forth, the traditional fishermen could not go out during the wartime, or that they had very small boats and they couldn't go out in storms and so forth. And then they saw the Italian and Japanese big boats, you know, fishing their fish there, and they couldn't get any benefit from that. So then what was left was the piracy as a way to showing that this is our area and this, we have some rights here. And then people turned from the fishing to the piracy. It might be a little bit too dramatic interpretation, but it has some points in it. And at least we should really look that overfishing is not really violating the livelihoods of some of these villages and some of these areas, like in the Somali coastline. Biodiversity was touched here already, and of course the world map is on the red in several places. Forest declining in tropics, this was already touched. Aha, now comes something. Plastic in the oceans is a new interesting. Today we have just been reading that the European Union is now planning to make a ban on how do you call this, pilli pipes, are they? Stores and cups, plastic cups, and so, because there are alternative materials available. And of course it's quite a dramatic, the news, but not only that there is a trash in the oceans, but also how these are going in the cycle and what kind of health problems can be caused. Then when this is, well, quite pessimistic data, has there some positive development? This is not about the species, this is about the international agreements. You know, how many international agreements we have had and how many countries have joined them. And you can say, well, this is at least positive. And we have actually some, I think it's CITES or Basel Convention, that are very high up. Almost all countries are already part of that. And this maybe also shows, you know, there has been international action. The problems have been addressed by these agreements. How effective these agreements are, that can be questioned. Actually, we have only one agreement, and it's the climate that is really this kind of binding, has a binding mechanism. And all of them other are more or less voluntary, which of course is a weakness. Maybe also what I'm always stressing is the role of the democracy. I already mentioned that if you want to be an environmental activist, you need freedom of speech, you need democracy, and so forth. And the map of democracy, of course, is quite important. I don't know now how it's developing. The full democracy is now I can see that the US is on the green, but how long it will be on the green, I don't know. We have some European countries there already on the yellow and so forth. Actually, the map of democracy is very important also when looking from the environmental point of view. Where you think about preconditions of global change, freedom of speech, freedom of media, transparency, accountability, combining environment and development, and then using information, legislative tools, global regulation, and market-based tools at the same time. We have always this philosophical discussion, should we have environmental taxes, or should we have a regulation, or should we have this or this or this? I think all these tools are needed, actually, at the same time and used in different situations. And then comes this development or environment first debate. I always remember when in the Finnish parliament, when we were young Greens, first time entered to the parliament, there were parliamentarians like Sulo Aittonen, somebody might remember, very conservative gentleman, close to Tampere, and I was always fighting with him on the environmental issues, and he told me in the parliament that, Pekka, these poor people don't care at all about the environment. They only care, you know, about their next day of life or that day of life, and they are not interested about the environment. And I was always arguing that, well, these poor people are so depending on the environment, their livelihood is destroyed or disappearing if they don't care. And then when I first time worked in places like Sudan, Darfur, or in Afghanistan, I could see actually that the poorest people always address the environment first, because the clean water, the agricultural land, the first concern, desertification, pollution of the water, it was always in their mind. Can you do something with the environment? And then I felt at the same time, of course, it's a tragic issue, but at the same time I felt that, yes, this is how it is. And we shouldn't underestimate how in the poorest countries people are, how concerned people are about the environment. And we can buy ourselves out from our problems, but they can only be environmental refugees in the worst case scenarios. And they should really not, we should be careful that people are not adopting polluting ways. I remember always in Vietnam when they were so happy that they have got some fertilizer from the West, I guess, so that the rice was going more rapidly in the rice fields. And then they were very happy. They said, oh, now we have a lot of rice is growing this year, and this is excellent result. But we have one problem. Now the fish is disappearing. So what chemical you put to the field, then you get the fish back. And, you know, it was again that we are in these chains and these problems. Just to prove that there are have been very active environmental activists like the Nobel Peace Prize winner Wangari Maathai 2004, lady who started this Pan-African Greenbelt Network, Women Planting Trees, excellent program many years ago. Nobel Peace Prize winner, of course, Al Gore, IPCC, was also an important stepstone. Then I'm coming to the end of my presentation, just mentioning some lessons learned in the Nordic countries. I think the civil society, non-governmental organizations are cooperating regionally and globally. It's something that we really need on the environmental arena. National strategies have to be in the framework of global challenges. Then access to information, like Aarhus Convention, very important for us. Environmental impact assessments over the borders, which Espoo Convention allows, good experiences of participatory processes. Even NGOs participating in the case of Finland, in the international delegations. We have somebody from Finnish Nature Protection Association or others in many of these international delegations. Current tensions in the use of natural resources globally, of course, mining industries, conflict with different use of land, forest industries, loss of biodiversity, rights of indigenous people, climate impacts of oil and gas sector, risk to the environment of, for example, of off-coast drilling in the Arctic areas, some parts of debate in Finland, land use conflict in Finland, in Lapland, mining, tourism, reindeers, indigenous rights of Sami people, quite a messy situation currently. Actually, the Finnish Parliament made a very, very interesting decision some weeks ago with this Canadian CETA agreement, the free trade agreement, where Parliament decided that our own mining law has to be renewed before the CETA agreement is in force. And it was particularly for the reason that if you make it afterwards, then theoretically at least, some Canadian company, mining company, can say, hey, this change of the legislation was made to prevent our businesses here and there and ask for the compensation. Theoretically, this could happen under these international agreements. Failure of environmental performance, compensation to landowners, like Talvivaara case, very, very sad case, of course, in our own history. I was one week ago in Sweden talking to Boliden company, and the Boliden company leader said that One issue I can tell you about the mining sector. Nothing happens rapidly in this sector. And you try to change the, so to say, the laws of the nature in Talvivaara, because if you look the whole development of this sector, it's always taken years and years and years to find the best processes and most effective processes. And you try to do in one night a mega thing, and it has never been successful in mining sector. And I have to say, I believed him. Huh? Sustainable forestry versus bioenergy, hydropower versus endangered fish, for example. I think Jasper Pääkkönen has done a lot in Finland on this sector. Energy dependency in Finland, the Russian. We were originally planning a Fennovoima nuclear power plant to be less dependent on Russia and be more dependent on Germany, EON. Then happened something, Croatia, whatever happened. And then suddenly you are with the Rosatom in the same bed again, and you are doing actually, you are increasing your dependency on Russia. Interesting thing. Circular economy as a rising trend, which was already mentioned very well by the Jyväskylä presentation, in your presentation. And then I'm finishing to this, the global goals. We have quite little time. Agenda 2030, 15 years period to fulfill the sustainable goals. And I'm actually always comparing this to the Millennium Development Goals, which were active year 2000 to 2015. This is much more environmentally orientated. Among these 17 goals, you have around 10. You have the oceans, you have the biodiversity, you have the climate. All key environmental goals are, I would say, finally there on the international agenda. And then, which I'm personally very happy, is also that the peace and justice and strong institutions are there. Because this, as I said, many countries who are in the deepest poverty, unfortunately, are the conflict countries where you conflicts are renewing and renewing, institutions are extremely weak. We have to do something also to support those institutions. I will finish here. Thank you.
Think locally and act locally. We are active here, but we are thinking to go. But for China, for example, several years ago, China was preventing any move towards sustainable development and everything because they were accelerating their economic growth. But now they are acting, now they are coming to the agreements and so on. And some countries they are trying now to jump out of the boat, like because they want to increase their growth. But in this term, how could we balance this this problem that among countries or inequality among countries? Because people who are undeveloped now, they are trying also to come up with their development, to come up with their economic growth, but this will affect the global, actually, even the environmental problem issues around the world. How could we balance this in order to make the world more better place to live? Thank you.
It's an important question. Very nice to have you here, and of course South Sudan and Sudan is close to my heart based on the work that I was doing also for the European Union there. And it's very unfortunate that the country that as you know, got the independence and was fighting for the independence, then slide back to the civil war. And I just met actually Finnish UNICEF people who have been there on the ground, and I met them, and luckily there are still organizations who help on the humanitarian issues, but of course it's back to the square one, so to say, the development, because many of the development agencies have left the country at the moment. They cannot, in the middle of these circumstances, do their work, which is negative. And of course, when I mentioned the River Nile, of course you have a great impact also, because the Nile begins from your country, and it's as a a lot of resources, but also a lot of responsibilities, of course, on River Nile. But you mentioned the China issue, and I didn't touch it so deeply on my presentation, but I have been always thinking that we China is somehow divided in one way. It's maybe pushing to the market many of these very irresponsible way productive things and others, but I could see when visiting in a recent Beijing is that somehow the direction is changing now. For example, last year they closed 100 ongoing projects to build new coal power plants, because they really are now taking this quality, air quality issues and others seriously. And I always get the feeling that the decision makers are now taking the environmental component much more seriously. And that, for that reason, I'm not only thinking that China's effect is, we always say, China's here, China's there, what are they doing, it's a negative impact. I'm not sure that it's always only negative. They are supporting social sector, they are making schools, they are making hospitals. They hopefully are also, for example, advancing in solar technology, and wind technology can do more important work on that. Maybe one issue came to my mind, and it's again about Africa and the young people. I was one time we Nigeria is famous in Finland, like in any other place, about the Nigerian letters. And I'm always saying that the Finns are the ones who most truly answer to all Nigerian letters. I think we are very blue-eyed people, and we always want to believe good about the people, and when somebody asks us or proposes a good business, we are eagerly responding positively. And so forth. But when visiting in Lagos, the internet cafes where people, rumor is that these are the guys who are doing the Nigeria, I don't know. I was thinking that, well, these guys have perfect English language. They can use computers. They are just unemployed youth with actually many skills. And why don't we think all these people, young people, as a resource through the education, you know, to why international companies are not using this labor, putting their businesses there, and so forth and so forth. And I think this kind of development Africa is lacking quite a lot. And we should have, of course, a couple of good examples, but then really push push this kind of working opportunities for the younger generation. I think it's very important. And when you look at the population pyramid or other needs in Africa, I think the challenge of the sustainable development very much for our generation is in this Europe-Africa relationship. What more can we do between us? And then maybe final issue, I'm always learning more. Africa is very, people are very independent minded, and they don't like to be patronized by anyone. And when you, for example, say to some African Union leaders, don't you see what China is doing here, this is a new colonialism, they say, hey, sorry, who is speaking? You are Europeans, you come there to tell us what is colonialism. Don't mind telling us that, you know, we know everything about colonialism, your history and others. So it's actually very important that you know this sensitivity. And sometimes some of our European colleagues don't still understand the history between these two continents. We are a little bit more innocent, we never had a colonial past in Finland and so forth, but the reputation of Europe, unfortunately, is still very much based on those very bad experiences and very sad history. And it's not yet handled in a proper way, always, on the other.
Okay, thank you. I think it's time to end this part of our seminar. I'm very pleased, and I would like to thank all the speakers tonight for excellent, insightful talks. I think we all learned quite much about sustainability and sustainable, how to make our life more sustainable, and also kind of about planetary well-being. And I would also like the audience for sacrificing this nice summer evening together with us, joining the Wisdom Network, which I said earlier that this is an open network and you are all welcome to join the network. So now you know what sustainable, what Wisdom Network is going to be about. At least you know the roadmap for Wisdom Network. So we are going to make a difference, and we are going to make things a little bit different way. And as an example of making things differently, I didn't introduce myself in the beginning. You probably now thought that this poor guy, he forgot to introduce himself, but I wanted to make a difference. So my name is Mikko Mänkkänen, and I very much welcome you to have class of sparkling wine with us and resource-wise pies as well. Thank you.